Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Now, I know this is a mixed audience this evening. Some of you are here, are experts on climate change. Some of you are here because you're citizens concerned about climate change. Some of you are here because you thought it was rather remarkable that I arranged for today to be a record-breaking hot day to illustrate the point. And some of you are probably here to see if it's possible for a former chancellor to talk about anything other than fundraising. And I hope to convince you that I can. So let me begin here. This study, this America's Climate Choices study, was conducted by what's commonly referred to as the National Academies. So the National Academies, as you can see, they consist of the National Academy of Engineering, the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, and their operating arm, the part of it that does, arranges studies and selects the panels and staffs them and provides for the travel and the like, is the National Research Council, the NRC. This is a pretty old organization. The National Academy of Sciences was established in 1863, a congressional charter signed by President Lincoln. And the idea was to provide advice to the nation, and I quote, on any subject of science or art. So which one of us isn't qualified to do that, of course? The National Academy of Engineering and the Institute of Medicine came later, indeed, 1964 and 1970. Each is a self-perpetuating society, sort of an honor society, and you get elected to membership. About 85% of the studies that they do are for the government, either the congressional branch or the executive branch. As written, they're funded on a project-by-project basis. There's no direct government funding for the academies. And this one that I'll be talking about today is one of those. Now, it's not the first study to have conducted by the academies on climate change. They've been doing them since 1979. There are about 30 of them by now. But almost all of those, no, indeed all of them, were the academy was asked the question to elaborate and elucidate some aspect of the science. It focused on climate science, some piece of it. Help us to understand this aspect of climate change science. What makes this study different? In this case, the academies were asked also for advice on what to do about climate change. Now, that's unusual. That's not what the academies ordinarily do. They sometimes do. But in the Department of Commerce Appropriation Act in 2008, one might ask, why the Department of Commerce? Turns out that's where the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration is located. Is the Department of Commerce. In their Appropriations Act, $5.8 million was allocated for a study to be performed by the academies, as it says there, to investigate and study the serious and sweeping issues relating to global climate change and make recommendations regarding what steps must be taken and what strategies must be adopted in response to global climate change, including the science and technology challenges thereof. That's it. That's it. So this was not a tightly constrained study, but it clearly says, what should we do? What strategies should we adopt? So it asks for action-oriented policy advice, which is something these academies usually don't get involved in. I'll have a little more to say about that later. So in response to this mandate from Congress, the academies developed this America's Climate Choices Project. These actually represent the five covers of five reports. There were four panels that were formed. One panel on advancing the science of climate change. One on limiting the magnitude of future climate change. One on adapting to the impacts of climate change. And one on informing effective responses to climate change. This last one, again, somewhat unusual for the academies, not simply a set of scientific questions. So there were the four panels. Then there was an overarching committee committee called the Committee on America's Climate Choices that was to provide overall direction and coordination and integration of the entire study and to prepare a final comprehensive report that sums it all up, that draws from the panel reports and any other source that it chose to, and that was the committee that I chaired. For those of you interested in any of this stuff, it's all available free, can be downloaded at americasclimatechoices.org. That's it. No apostrophe in Americas for that purpose. Here's the mandatory picture you have to have. This involved over 90 people. Well, they always point out unpaid because participants in this study, it's all pro bono. I'll have a, now the staff of the National Academies get paid, the expenses get paid, the travel, the meeting rooms. I hate to think of what the carbon footprint of this project was. But there were, it's unusual in the breadth of its scope and therefore is unusual in the breadth of backgrounds of the participants. So there are climate scientists and engineers and lawyers and social scientists and business leaders, former elected officials, community organizers, and more. And each of them, as I say, since none of us were paid, they had to have some support in one form or another from their institution, hosting, whether it be a university or a government agency or a not-for-profit organization. So I'm grateful to UCLA for providing the institutional support that enabled me to participate in this. Now, I don't. This is not an eye chart. I don't expect anybody in the back to be able to read it. This is a list of the members, but I thought I'd give you an idea of the diversity of the membership of this committee. First of all, it included the chairs and the vice chairs of each of the four panels. That was enormously helpful in trying to coordinate the work of the panels. They all sat on this committee. It included four members of the National Academy of Sciences, two members of the National Academy of Engineering, some other distinguished folks. But let me mention some. My vice chair, Bill Tremades, is the Dean of the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. Jim Geringer, former governor of Wyoming, coal state, Republican, coal state. Chad Holliday, currently the chairman of Bank of America, formerly chairman and CEO of DuPont Chemical Corporation. Pam Madsen, superstar scientist at Stanford, dean of their School of Earth Sciences. Dick Schmalensee, superstar economist, former dean of the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Phil Sharp, president of Resources for the Future, leading environmental organization, and a former congressman. Peggy Shepard, an executive director of We Act for Environmental Justice, a community organization. Susan Solomon, a distinguished National Academy scientist on climate. Bjorn Stigson, a businessman and president of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. It's an organization of about more than 200 international corporations. The final report of this committee is about 80 pages long, plus preface and, you know, acknowledgments and references and all that stuff, but about 80 pages. But before it got to be printed and issued, it had to go through a rigorous review process conducted by the academies. There were 15 anonymous reviewers selected by the academies who we didn't know their names until after the reviews were completed so we could acknowledge them in the report. There were 96 pages of comments from the reviewers. The report was 80 pages long. And we had to convince the academies that we had appropriately dealt with every comment, either by proving that we shouldn't make the change that had been suggested, or by making change where there was merit to the suggestion, but it would not be approved by the academy until it went through that process. In going through it, I'd like to say a few words. This is something you won't find in any of the reports. What were some of the challenges and issues of just getting this group to reach any kind of consensus, even to come up with an approach on this study? So let me begin First of all, the audience. Who's the audience? We're supposed to advise the nation. Did that mean Congress who called for the study? Does it mean just the federal government? Does it mean all levels of government? We decided that it would be leaders whose decisions will determine America's response to climate change. So that's leaders in the federal government. It's leaders in every state government. It's leaders in business. It's leaders in major NGOs. But it is not written with advice for the average citizen on what he or she, himself or herself, should do, but rather about they can understand what policies the nation should adopt and can become involved in that debate. The international context, we were asked to advise the nation. But if there's any problem that's an international problem, a global problem, it's climate change. There's only one atmosphere, and it's over all of the countries. So how do you do this? We decided, okay, we're not supposed to be advising the world. We're providing advice for the United States, but it's got to be in an international context, understanding and taking into account what the rest of the world is doing and might do. The analytical framework. What's a way to think about approaching this problem? There are several models that sometimes we have experience in our personal life or business life, but also in government. One is often called the precautionary principle. Just make sure that the worst possible things don't happen. Don't worry about anything else. Just look out for the worst possible things. Another is our typical approach to really hard problems. The name that's used in the literature for that is muddling through. In other words, as you're going along, sort of figure out what you have to do. Another very common one is cost-benefit analysis, which sounds very highly analytical. But now when you go to apply it to this problem, it's not so easy to figure out how you even think about the costs, let alone how you put them in dollars. So what is it worth if an animal species becomes extinct because of climate change? How many dollars is that? That's pretty hard to do. How's about how much money should you think of as the cost if a small island nation has its country covered with water? Not a lot of people, maybe 100,000, there are 6 billion on Earth, who's going to miss them? Wrong, number one. Number two, how do you put a dollar? So if you're going to try and do cost-benefit analysis, you have to realize you're doing it conceptually, not as a strict economic analysis. Scenarios and models. Now, these are terms that have very special meaning in this field. Scenarios refers to, if I'm going to be looking at how much CO2 or other greenhouse gases are going to be emitted into the atmosphere in the next 50 years or 100 years, because that will determine in large measure how much global warming we will have and what the significance of it will be, I only need to know a few things. What the population will be is a function of time. How the economy will do for the next century in every country, what kind of sources of energy they will use, how efficient it will be, what they will use for agriculture. You can get the point. Nobody knows what those are going to be like for the next 50 years. It doesn't mean you can't make estimates. And so what you do is you pick scenarios that some basis to try and, well, here's a high emission scenario and a low emission scenario. Then we use computer models, given that input, and what will be the effect on the climate of those emissions. Well, that too, we don't have perfect models of the climate, given what the greenhouse gases will be. As a matter of fact, if you ask precisely what will the temperature be here, right outside Fowler, 2 weeks from today at noon, we know a lot. I can give you a pretty good idea, but I can't tell you precisely what it's going to be. Our models aren't even good enough for that, but they're pretty good. They're pretty good, but there's a lot more to be learned. And which scenarios should we use? Which models? This was a debate. Technological change. Here my only admonition is humility here. If you're looking to mid-century or the end of the century and trying to predict the technologies, Let's say mid-century. That's like the easy one. It's only 39 years. So let's go back 39 years, right? No cell phones, no internet, right? No MRIs, no Dolly the Sheep cloning, no a lot of things that we take for granted. So you got to be some humility in projections of technology. Characterization of uncertainties. I'm not going to spend the same amount of time on each of these, but this turns out to be an important one in this field in general. Scientists, when they talk about things in which uncertainties are involved, have two characteristics. First of all, they want to make sure that every sentence contains the word uncertainty at least once to make it clear that it's not positive. There's some uncertainty here. That's one aspect of it that's very important to them. Secondly, that's what they're most interested in. Because what does uncertainty mean? That's where the exciting research is to be done. That's where we need new knowledge. That's where the interest is. It's not on what we already know. It's on what we don't know. Now, readers, non-scientists, you say the word uncertainty, by the time they've said it four times in the first paragraph, the assumption is they just don't know. They just don't know. And so we had to find some way, how do you get around this problem? Because we know a lot. We know a lot. But the scientists are quite reticent to say, well, we know a lot, but not everything. They want to make it clear. They want to make sure we add, but not everything, to every sentence. What we managed to do, the way we got agreement here, is they were quite concerned about making recommendations, some of the scientists. They say, wait a minute. Recommendations is advocacy. If I become an advocate, I'm no longer viewed as objective. And the policy people among us try to go, no, wait a minute. Being objective doesn't mean you have no opinion. It just means you're open to change your judgment based on new evidence. It doesn't mean you don't have an opinion. If you're the best informed people, you mean you shouldn't tell anybody? Because that would be advocacy? So on things they felt strongly about, well, they were quite confident that was right, we were able to make recommendations. Implementation, well, policy objectives and priorities. That's one, when I left that out, one way to think of it is, what should be the objective? Is it to get things down to an acceptable risk? Is it to try and achieve fairness in the world? Is it just worry about your own nation, don't worry about anybody else? What are your objectives? What are you trying to do? So let me get back on track here. Implementation and governance. It's one thing to make a bunch of recommendations, but if it's not realistic to implement them, either because the country isn't organized to be able to do that, doesn't have the institutions, because these things not only have to be done, but need to be done over a long period of time. They have to be sustained. And how do you think about that? Skepticism. In the course of this study, early on, there were these events that involved the emails among some climate scientists that were, I guess hacked is the right word to use, from University of East Anglia in the UK. And there were some things in that that provided some ammunition for anti-climate change types. There were also a few errors in the last international study done through under the auspices of the UN, the International Panel on Climate Change. The latest report was 2007. Some very minor things in it, but not right. So the skepticism suddenly increased. And then the final challenge was the report was to be a consensus report, one on which every member of the panel signs off, from former governors to lawyers to heads of environmental groups to business people to academics and the like. So those are some of the major challenges along the way. Findings is the Academy's fancy word for conclusions. So let me start with a couple of them. I'll have five in the course of this talk, and then some some statements about recommendations. Fine. Can you read this from the back? Yeah, some. Yeah, some can. Good. I can just about make it out from here. The committee confirms that, because the wording is very careful. The committee confirms that climate change is occurring, is very likely caused primarily by human activities, and poses significant risks to human society and the natural environment. Now, when we put the word confirms there, we mean confirms, corroborates. This is not a new idea. This is not a new finding. This is what scientists have been finding for some years now. But we didn't want to trust the analyses that had done before, our science panel in particular. They went back to all the original published literature and evaluated. They looked at all the literature that's been published since the IPCC report of 2007. And when you analyze all the additional information, it confirms that. And that's what those things mean. Now, the next one is a conclusion and a judgment mixed together. It says, these risks indicate a pressing need for substantial action to limit the magnitude of climate change. Most of that means reducing the emission of greenhouse gases. That's the single most important thing. And to prepare for adapting to its impacts. Of course, there is climate change, and there's going to be more. No matter what we do, how much more depends on what we do. So this is right? If I'm an engineer scientist, I've got to have at least one slide, you know, that satisfies the people that do that. But none of these require deep analysis to get the point. They're useful. So this graph on the upper left here, this is the trends of the temperature just about at the surface of the Earth, how it's been increasing since 1880 to 2010 or so. It is not hard to tell that the Earth is warming. Now, you can argue about why. We'll get to that in a minute. But anybody that says global warming isn't happening, these are measurements with thermometers, not just thermometers, from satellites, all kinds of things. Very carefully done. We've got good stuff. I wouldn't have as much confidence in the numbers before 1920, how precise they are, as I would after that. But we've been able to measure temperature pretty well. And once you get past into the 1950s, where the climb is the steepest, we've had satellites up there. So these are good measurements. There is no doubt the Earth is getting warmer. Now, this next slide is intended to show, although you can't completely prove it from this slide, that human activities are largely responsible. And here what you have on the left-hand axis, it's the concentration of carbon dioxide, the principal greenhouse gas that humans put into the atmosphere, the concentration as a function of years, from 1800 to about 2000. And for the graph that goes with that axis, it's the reddish one, magenta in the report, which sounds much better than reddish somehow. And you can see that the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere doesn't start from zero, because there's a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's not from burning fossil fuels. But look at how it rose after the Industrial Revolution. It just goes off the chart, almost literally. Now, if you take the other curve, the dark colored one, which goes with the axis on the right, that shows how many billion tons of carbon per year we've been putting in the atmosphere. And it's not much until the Industrial Revolution. And then you look at it just after World War II, and it takes off. It's been going up at average rate of 6 or 7% per year, compounded. That's what's been happening. Now, we also looked hard at, well, what are other explanations for this temperature rise? Might it be just natural climate variations? No, we got lots of good data on that. What about solar output? Let's face it, the sun doesn't always put out the same amount of energy. There are some cycles. But we've had satellites up there for 50 years. We got very good data on solar output. That doesn't explain it. Might it be cosmic rays? Good data No. What about volcanoes? Because volcanoes have mixed effects on the climate. The answer, nope, that doesn't explain it either. So we looked at the alternatives as well, and we keep coming back to, this is global warming due to the greenhouse effect primarily. Whoops. So it turns out global warming is accurate. It does describe what's happening, but it can be a little bit misleading instead of the term climate change, which is what people use now. It is true that the average temperature of the Earth's surface is increasing. That's what global warming refers to. But the warming varies from place to place. It's not that it's gone up 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century, which is the average. It's not like it's done that everywhere on Earth. Some places more, some places less. The warming will continue for decades to come, even if we didn't put any more CO2 into the atmosphere. If we put more, it will warm more and faster. But the warming will continue. And warming has important effects on weather patterns. And those are the really important effects. It's not simply, gee, but the Earth might be 3 degrees warmer. If you live in Minnesota, that's a pretty good idea. Could you make it 5 degrees? On the other hand, if you live in the tropics or in sub-Sahara, it's 5 degrees warmer. Oh, our agriculture won't make it. So we prefer to use climate change. So that refers to the weather patterns. It refers to things that you think about, like averages, whether you're talking about average temperatures or average rainfalls or all that. It will affect that. It will affect the extremes. It will affect where things take place, whether they're droughts or floods. It will affect the timing, when they will occur. Not in ways that we can predict directly. We can predict the average will go up, there will be more extremes, etc., but not exactly. And other things that are characteristics of the climate. Is it hot or cold, cloudy or clear, humid or dry? Does it drizzle or do you get more downpours? Snow versus rain, ice versus water? Do you get more tornadoes and hurricanes? Now, some of the impacts of climate change, not only the rising average temperature, but you would expect more storms. You would expect more heat waves. You would expect more droughts. You would expect more floods. You would expect the sea level to rise as the sea gets warmer. You would expect that the polar ice would melt more than it ordinarily would. You would expect, if the Earth is warmer, there'd be more rain and less snow. And all of these turn out to be terribly important. So let's look at a couple of examples. Here's one to illustrate, well, what about warmer? And we'll just talk about the United States here. So on our upper left here, this map, that's, first let me say, the redder it is, the more days there are over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The very darkest red is more than 120 days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The lowest, the closest to whitish yellow, is less than 10 days a year over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, we live in the Southwest, so it's worth focusing on that part. This graph in the upper right shows what might be anticipated at the end of this century, between 2080 and the year 2100, 2080 to 2099, for a low emission scenario. Not too bad. This one, the one on the bottom, is for a high emission scenario. So let me give you a couple of examples. In California's Central Valley, we're looking over there, there, and there. California's Central Valley, now about 30 days a year, it's over 100 degrees. Under a low emission scenario, it would become about 80 days a year. High emission scenario, about 110 days a year, over 100 degrees. Or how's about, let's take the hottest parts of Arizona, which are the hottest places in the country. They now have nearly 75 days a year over 100 degrees. Even at the low scenario, it'll be way over 120 days. It's as red as you can make it. And if you talk about the high scenario, they're lucky if they have a day each year when it drops below 100. Here's another way to look at it, the implications of climate change. And here, too, we're going to look at A low emission scenario, those are the ones that are sort of tan, and the high emission scenario is red, and there are basically two time frames, mid-century and end of century. So it's what will Illinois feel, let me get back here. What will it feel like in mid-century? Well, it depends. Is it the high scenario, the brown, or the red, the closest to Illinois, or at the end of the century, or a little further down? So if you do a little geography, Illinois will feel roughly like Texas. The difference is whether it's North Texas or South Texas. If you talk about, what about Michigan, what will it feel like? It'll feel like either Kansas or Oklahoma. Well, now that might not seem like such a big deal, but you may have noticed when you go to Texas, the crops are not the same crops that you grow in the Plain States or in the North. So it has big effects on many, in many ways. Freshwater resources. One of the things that climate change does is it speeds up the water cycle. From, you know, rain or snow comes down, then lots of things happen to the water. Some of it goes into the ground, some of it's absorbed by plants, some of it falls on the ocean. Eventually it all winds up going back into the atmosphere, and then it comes down again as rain or snow. That's the water cycle. That's been speeding up and will continue to speed up. It tends to make wet places wetter and dry places drier. More of it comes in the form of heavy precipitation, downpours instead of drizzles. That leads to flooding. There's changes in snow and ice cover, which affect water availability. What's the principal source of water in the United States? Well, certainly in the western United States, in the winter. Melting snow. If there's less snow, you got less fresh water. Or even if you had the same amount of snow, if it all melted in the winter before you got to spring, that also doesn't help. Crops, effect on agriculture. This graph is sort of the yield per acre, what's been happening since 1960, and what average, overall, all crops. And what has been the effect, best we can tell, just of the warming and the CO2 in the atmosphere? And the answer is crops are expected to be down by, it's about 20% is the middle there by the end of the century. That's globally. In places where agriculture is marginal, it's all over. The crop yield will be zero. Other impacts of climate change, sea level rise. So here's low emission scenarios and high emission scenarios. It shows how much the sea level is, how much it's risen, and how much is expected to rise depending on which scenario you use. If you go out here to the far end and sort of try and look in the middle roughly, that's just about 100 centimeters, 1 meter. If the sea level goes up 1 meter, New Orleans is 91% underwater. Miami is 18% underwater. New York's about 7% underwater. And that doesn't include the fact that the subways are all underwater. So important implications for mass transit, for a whole bunch of things. This is serious stuff. And we've got good measurements of what we're able to measure the temperature of the sea pretty well. So I talked about uncertainty. Let me just remind you and say a couple more what the key sources of uncertainty are. One is projecting future greenhouse gas emissions. As I said, you have to assume a lot about the population, the energy sources, all that stuff, and you try and get a range, high and low. Estimating the effects of the greenhouse gases on climate. As we get better and better climate models and better measurements, we can do better at that. The vulnerabilities to climate change. Well, what will the effects be of floods and droughts, etc., of downpours, of less snow? Trying to understand that better, because it gives you a better chance on how do we deal with them. Advances in technology. Might we find ways to, for example, have clean hydrocarbons, ways in which we could, instead of the CO2 going up the smokestack, were able to get the CO2 out and sequester it someplace. Maybe Royce Hall. No, not a good idea. Not Royce Hall. I used it the other, somewhere on the UC, on the USC campus, but I'm not sure exactly. So it could be that you remove it from the atmosphere. In theory, we know how to do that chemically, but trying to do it on an industrial scale. There are other ways. What is it in nature that's very good at taking carbon dioxide out of the air? Trees, right? Great. Trees, just plant trees everywhere. Is that the strategy the world seems to be following? How's about cut down trees everywhere? Seems to be a little bit. How about algae, green algae? Great idea. Cover the oceans with algae. Well, what would be the effects of that? So that's somewhat questionable. Those, when you talk about algae or trees, you're talking about the last one, geoengineering, literally engineering the earth. The two ways we think about it, greenhouse gas removal from the atmosphere, and the other is solar radiation management, which means reflect more of the sun's energy back into space before it gets to warm up the earth. How's about putting mirrors up in space? May not be so crazy. People have certainly thought about that. What about, there are certain kinds of aerosols that if you put them in the atmosphere actually reduce the greenhouse effect. You could put particles of things that would reflect sunlight. You could paint everything white, right? Because white reflects more sunlight. How much of a difference would these things make? We have no idea. What might be the unintended consequences? For example, of lots of algae. I don't know whether the fish would like it or not. I certainly know that any life down below the algae that's dependent upon sunlight getting through is going to be very unhappy with this notion. Another thing that's happening, by the way, to the oceans is they're getting more and more acidic because of the CO2. And that could be pose a threat to some forms of ocean life. So geoengineering, risky stuff, but probably deserves research because as horrible as it is, we may need it. Let's hope we don't, that we do other things instead. So a couple of more conclusions that follow from this. We're always going to be facing uncertainties about climate risk, but uncertainty is not a reason for inaction. To the contrary, it can be an important reason for action. None of you are certain that your house will go up in fire. As a matter of fact, it's very unlikely. But it's a good idea to have fire insurance because the consequences are so bad. None of you, each year, on your birthday, probably say in any degree of seriousness, damn, I wasted that life insurance money again. Made it through another year, didn't die, paid a premium, wasted that money. You're glad you wasted the money. Again, because the consequences to your family and loved ones of not having life insurance may be so great. So uncertainty is not a reason for not doing anything. And the fact that there is uncertainty doesn't mean we don't know anything. We know about the greenhouse effect. More greenhouse gases, more warming. That's not one of the scientific uncertainties. This argues for using a strategy that's used all the time in other areas, iterative risk management, by which we mean you're going to have a portfolio of things that you're doing, and you take action to reduce the risk, but you're constantly taking into account new information and new measurements, and you're adjusting the resources you put in each tool in your toolkit or each element of your portfolio on a regular basis. Anybody's got an investment portfolio? Does this. Unless you want to take your chances. Say, I'll put it all in Enron. It was really doing well. It seemed like a great idea. And unfortunately, a number of people did that who worked for Enron because they got such a great deal to do so. Now, most of us say, well, I'll pass on some of that. I'll buy some Enron. But I'll buy some bonds. and I'll buy some stable companies. So it's a portfolio, and you get new information. You don't change it, you have to change it every day, but you change it from time to time to reflect what you've learned and what has happened. Same here. That's what we recommend. And the final of the conclusions, and then I'll get to recommendations, is current climate change response efforts, which are primarily at the local and state governments, non-government organizations, and the private sector, are not likely to yield progress comparable to what could be achieved with strong national policies and leadership. What's being done at these other levels is very important and very helpful. We'd hate to see it go away. But it's not going to be sustainable without some national engagement in this. And even if it's sustained, it probably wouldn't be enough. So now we get to the recommendations. The overarching recommendation in which everything else, essentially the recommendation is treat this as an iterative risk management problem. That's the overall thing. And then here are the elements of your portfolio. And you should be adjusting what you do to that. So the overarching is develop and adopt a risk management strategy that's durable enough to provide sustained progress and long-term, promote sustained progress and long-term investments. In other words, a strategy and a policy that investors can rely on to some extent, as opposed to having to worry that suddenly the strategy is going to change and it suddenly disfavors solar or wind or whatever you might, any other clean energy source you know of. It should be flexible enough at the same time to take advantage of improvements in knowledge and new technologies. And it's that means it's got to be iterative. You've got to be revisiting it. You don't have to change it every day, but you've got to be revisiting it annually, whatever, and say, well, what is it that we know now that we didn't know before that we change what we do? So there's the list of all the recommendations, but since I'm going to do them one by one, I'll skip to that. So the first is limit the magnitude of climate change. And this is primarily about greenhouse gas emissions. The nation should reduce greenhouse gas emissions substantially over the coming decades. Exactly how much? Well, that depends on how much risk we want to take as a society. It's our judgment, the committee's judgment, that the most effective strategy is to begin ramping down emissions as soon as possible. As soon as possible doesn't mean everybody in the country has to agree with us, but having looked at it hard, we believe that would be the best way to go. How to do it? There's all these debates about whether it should be a tax on carbon, putting carbon into the atmosphere. Should there be cap and trade? That's secondary. The most efficient way, most economists would agree, would be to tax it. Right now, you can put the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. You don't pay anything. It's a social cost. Everybody else has to pay for the climate change. But you don't pay any more than anybody else if you're a utility or whatever it is you do. If you put a tax on it, on doing that, that does a couple of things. First of all, it provides incentives for whoever's using hydrocarbon fuel to get a lot as efficient as they can get to make up for, because now they have to weigh the taxes against the use of the fuel. It provides people looking at alternatives some incentive. Gee, if burning coal is going to be more expensive, maybe that looks a little better for this idea I have for solar or wind or geothermal or whatever it is. So that's also particularly up. Whether it's tax or cap on trade, we're fine with. Then there are a bunch of other things. You can have regulations. You can have mandates. You can have public subsidies, which, of course, we have for solar and wind and nuclear. You can make them bigger. You could make them smaller. But our general view is, if you don't do something about CO2 emissions, this other stuff isn't going to do it. The second recommendation, reduce the vulnerability to climate change impact. We need some adaptation planning. Climate change is taking place. More of it will take place. We need it at all levels of society because generally it's local, right? It may be that parts of the country, New Orleans, is going to be 91% underwater. To the people of Idaho, that's not a big problem, or so they might think. So most of adaptation takes place locally, but we need the federal government to coordinate this activity so we can all learn from each other and build durable institutions that can implement these adaptations over time. But it's got to be in parallel. It's not instead of reducing emissions. Third one, invest in research and development. I've given the reasons for this, everything from improving our understanding of the causes and consequences and enhancing our ability to respond. You know, finding better gizmos that will help, finding ways to get carbon out of the air, finding ways that can reduce this problem. Four, develop effective information system. Again, the federal government should take the lead. We're not saying the federal government should do all of these things, but it's the principal coordinating institution for developing, supporting, and coordinating the information systems that we need to inform and evaluate America's climate choices. As we said, there are lots of people making these choices. We want them to do it on the best information that they can and to be able to evaluate what they've done so they can see if it's working or not, should it be modified, and to ensure legitimacy and access to things like climate service, the greenhouse gas accounting systems, and educational information. Let's say greenhouse gas accounting systems. Let's say I have a manufacturing plant, and I'm limiting my greenhouse gases. First of all, I want it to be measured so I can prove to everybody I'm really doing what I'm supposed to do. But equally importantly, perhaps even more so, I want my competitors to have to limit their greenhouse gases to, and I want some sort of an accounting system that gives me comfort that that's actually happening. Recommendation five, link scientific analysis and public deliberation. The short part of this is none of this effort can be sustained without public support. If you're going to have public support for this, it can't be just scientists talking to scientists or just debates between one of the 98% of the scientists who believe this is a real problem and one of the 2% who doesn't. In which case, people conclude, well, they don't know. There's two sides to this story. We've got to engage the public in these discussions so they can get a sense of what do we really know, what is it we don't know, and what difference do the uncertainties make. Engage internationally. I said there's only one atmosphere. The United States should actively engage in international climate change response efforts, reducing greenhouse gases, enhancing adaptation, especially in developing countries, and advancing research and observations about this. Now, one might say, let's make this clear, suppose only the United States, or the United States and a couple, reduce greenhouse gases and do these things. Won't the climate change problem be roughly the same? The answer to that is yes. We'd postpone it a little bit. So why should the United States do anything? Why does it have to take the lead? Well, first let's start with, of the industrialized country, we emit more greenhouse gases than any other. Only China's ahead of us. Hard to describe them as an industrialized country. There are parts of it are. And China's got nearly five times as many people as we have. So per capita, we put out about four times as much as is put out for every Chinese. Between the United States, China, and the European Union, that's about 50% of the greenhouse gases that are emitted each year. But the growth is expected to come from the developing countries. That's where most of they're developing now, and they're using more fossil fuels. That's why what they do is very, it doesn't matter a lot for climate change, whether that ton of carbon dioxide came from Indonesia producing products to be bought in the United States or from the United States. Matter of fact, if you accounted for our imports and said that carbon emission should also be, you know, assigned to us, then we're the leading CO2 emitter in the world. So action by, and we and the Europeans have put up most of the carbons in the atmosphere now. We did it. So it is not surprising that the rest of the world would say, well, we're certainly not going to do anything if you don't do anything. So I believe that I am not at all confident that if we do what needs to be done, that others will follow. But I am about as confident as I can be is that if we don't do what needs to be done, others won't do it either. And finally, of the recommendations, the federal government should facilitate coordination of the many interrelated components of America's response to climate change. Those are all of those seven items in the portfolio. And we need federal leadership on this. We have enough trouble in the federal government just getting coordination between the Department of Energy and EPA and the Department of Defense. But we also have to coordinate with state and local governments and businesses and the like. So this is my final slide. Once again, it's the cover of the five reports, but I want to use it as an opportunity to say we are not naive. We, the members of the committee, or me, we recognize that there are substantial obstacles to action along these lines, that currently there's a rancorous political debate. It's a matter, this is somehow like creationism. Either you believe in it or you don't. Indeed, the senator who is the ranking member on the Committee on Environment and Public Works has said, this is a direct quote, "The threat of catastrophic global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people." And when our report came out, he sort of condemned it and said, well, there's nothing new here. Well, it's not new. That's right. We said, not scientifically, we said the same thing. We confirmed the Earth is warming. It's due primarily to human action, and it poses significant risks to humankind and to our environment. So he's not going to be happy until a report says, they're all wrong. Turns out it's not happening. And what humans have been doing, thank God they've been doing it, it's making things better. Public opinion since the recession. If you ask people in 2006, if you ask them, is there solid evidence that there's climate change is occurring and it's mostly caused by human activity, a very large majority of them thought the answer to that is yes, said the answer was yes. When you asked it this year, it's still a majority that says yes, but it's down by 20 percentage points. It's a lot easier to accept and to believe to say, gee, I'm not so sure this is really happening, so we don't have to do anything that would cost money. It's easier to say that than to say, gee, this is really happening. It's going to be terrible for my kids and grandkids, but I don't want to spend any money on it now. So it's easier to just, all the new science that's come in makes the case more strongly. There's nothing that's happened in science that makes the case weaker, but it's amazing what a recession can do to your views on science. So what we hope is that these reports will provide a strong and a credible and a widely accepted base on which we can have the political debates about how much risk do we want to take and how do we want to try and set up some portfolio to be managed so that the risk to the future of our species and our planet is not threatened beyond that risk. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.